Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I saw those. Those were the darndest photos I've seen in a while. I mean, just caterpillar yellow sticking up through the muck.
Yeah, exactly. And I've gone in there, and of course, in Photoshop, I can blow it up and look really close. And what that thing is a motor grader that they use on highways and such. It's got a big bucket on the back that scrapes dirt and takes it to another location and dumps it out. The tractor is separate from it. It's a two-piece machine. And the only thing I can think of is they were moving ash either out onto the dam or they were taking ash out of the pond. There were no reports from anybody in the community of machinery working at 12:30 when that thing blew out, but it had to have been parked there. If it wasn't working, it was parked there. And it's full of material. When you look at the photographs closely, you can see that it's full of material.
So the inference that one draws from that, John, they knew.
Exactly. Now, and another thing, in some of my photographs, you look close. You got South Wings. If anybody don't know South Wings and they're in this movement, you need to know them. South Wings got me in the air. And I got the first high-resolution photographs that came out from up there. And it was really kind of, it was overwhelming. It took me a long time in editing to figure out exactly what I was looking at. And I can pinpoint now where the breach happened. And this machine is sitting right in the middle of the breach. Now, if it wasn't working, it had to have been parked right there where this thing breached. Normally, that wouldn't sound like such a bad thing, but this dam had been leaking to a point where they had actually dug a pond. They put a pond below the dam to catch the water that was weeping through the dam and then pump it back across the ash pit into a pond adjacent to it. And you can see that pipeline in my photograph. If they knew that thing was in such bad condition that they were having to pump water away from it to keep it from failing, what are they doing parking heavy equipment on it? None of this makes sense to me.
No, it's reckless conduct, John. I mean, legally reckless conduct.
Clearly said, well, I won't say clearly. You have to really hunt for it because it looks like a blur. But once you realize what it is, you see it in several photographs that PDA helicopters hovering over this piece of machinery. There's no way they can deny knowledge that it is there.
It's being pointed out in the chat room by Nanette. She said it's just like Buffalo Creek. They knew it was going to blow.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Nanette. Yes. They not only knew it was going to blow, but I think they knew to within a few weeks of when it would happen, because there's a gentleman who, and I told you this when I first talked to you, sitting on the side of the road up there that night. There was a gentleman I met who refused to be identified, who told me that TVA made him stop fishing around the out of that dam with no reasoning whatsoever, just said, after 40 years, you can't fish here anymore. That was right where the breach happened, and that same man, now I've got him on channel, one of the, I think it's NBC or one of the big networks, interviewed him. He owns some cattle right above where the breach happened. And I believe that man could be located, and he'd tell you the same story now, that something was wrong or they wouldn't have run him out of there after 40 years.
Yeah, because it seems a little precipitous just at, well, yeah, 40 years, you know, year after year. And then suddenly, now you got to go? You don't just do that. That doesn't just happen.
No. Well, have you had a chance to go up and look at my my map site that I put up on this?
I have seen it once. I have not given it the study that it deserved, frankly, John, but I have seen it.
Okay. When you get a chance, I'll get you the web address to it. I've updated that thing quite a bit now, and I've got photographs in there that show the mixed line or the plume of ash that's moving through the river.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually got it documented 25 miles downstream at the Watts Bar, the dam there at Watts Bar. We've got ash on the lower end of the dam 25 miles away. The where the ash is being dredged in the most recent photographs that I took, you can see the plume of mud, and this is where the heavy metals, the arsenic, and all this stuff is going to be located in this mud, right where our samples showed 300 times the allowable limit for arsenic. They're dredging. They're pulling logs out, and it's creating a plume that you can see being drawn through the power plant. All the water there goes through the power plant, and as long as that plant is running, it's pulling the water straight off the ash pile and discharging it through the power plant.
So they're just compounding their problem then?
Well, in legal terms, that's an intentional bypass of the permit.
Yes, it is. And that power plant has never slowed down. The power plant hadn't slowed down for a minute, has it, John?
No, they're not going to. If there were a waterkeeper program there, we would sue immediately. But, you know, you got to have standing.
Yeah.
Someone in that area needs to be paying attention to that because it's a daily violation if they create a mix line. If the water coming out of that plant is darker than the water in the plant's river by 50 NTUs, and it's a legal term, nephelometric units, but anyway, if that water creates a mix line there that is darker than the river, it is a violation. And if they're pulling this stuff off the ash pile and pushing it through there, it has to be discharging all the metals that are in that sludge.
Right back out.
Right. Because they're pulling the water off the ash pile.
Well, I was going to ask you, what are they doing? You mentioned dredging and so forth, John. What are they doing with what they're dredging? I mean, where did the ashbergs go?
Well, the ashbergs are still where they were, but in the most recent photographs, after rain, you'll see them. They're starting to seek level. They're starting to pancake out, flatten out. So it's filling, it's seeking level under the water. It's filling in what they call the embayment of the Emory River. I like that term they created, the embayment. Not an impoundment. We didn't stop it up. We just made a bay out of it.
Yeah, it's just a bay. It's a nice place to go sailboat.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Just taking the language out and torturing it. Yeah.
It's completely full. And from the air, you can look down and see that it's just within a few feet of the surface. This is bad business. Every time it rains, those ashbergs are dissolving. It's sort of like taking a piece of sand and dropping it into a glass of water. It stays in a clump for a little while, and then it flattens out on the bottom of the glass. This stuff is doing that exact same. It's seeking level in the Emory River, and we've got billions of yards of it. So as they dredge it, they're stirring up the cloud of mud.
Well, sure, it's like any country boy knows. The more you stir it, the more it stinks.
10-4. It's bad. The mix line at the Tennessee River. You got the Emory River flows into the Clinch, then the Clinch into the Tennessee.
Right.
The mix line at the Tennessee River after the first rain was so stark, so clear and evident that you could see it from like 2 or 3 miles out in the airplane. You could see it And that's the one that we followed 25 miles. That mud plume, 25 miles down the Tennessee River. And it's, you know, that fine clay, that's where the toxins, that's where the heavy metals are in this stuff. It's not dirt. You got to remember, this is not dirt. It's coal waste. It's coal combustion waste.
It's poison.
Exactly. That website is www.imrivers.com/TVA ash. And that's a map site that I've got up there that shows this 25 miles of migration of this stuff, the Tennessee River. And I've also got Widow's Creek on there. And I hadn't seen you since Widow Creek.
That's true.
Widow Creek wasn't quite as bad, but in a lot of ways, the scenario was worse. Because in this one, the pipe, calls it a leaky pipe.
Yeah, I saw that.
The leaky pipe they're talking about is an overflow pipe to the pond. They put these big pipes in the pond to where when the water reaches a certain level, it flows over the top and only water goes out through the pipe into the retention pond. This one became stopped up with ash, not logs and limbs and but just ash. This stuff sets up like cement.
Yeah.
We went through several years of drought conditions where it became, you know, more and more solid. It became hardened. And instead of boring it out, cleaning it out, raising the elevation of it to make the pond deeper, they just went to another area and put in a new overflow pipe and let that one fill up. The ash covered it over. Everybody forgot about it. Nobody thought about this thing again. Well, the drought ended. We started getting rain, and the material that was in the pipe started becoming solvent, saturated again. So it got soft, and when it blew out, a 36-inch hole opened up in the bottom of that pond and was like a siphon. It was sucking the water out of the pond. It drained over 100 acres of that gypsum pond into Widow Creek, and they said they only lost 10,000 gallons. We're talking millions again. And the bottom hadn't been sampled there. The folks at United Mountain Defense really had it on the ball in Tennessee. They went in, they got their samples fast, they did everything. You know, it took a little help from everybody to get that done. But unfortunately, in Widow Creek when it happened, I'm from Alabama and I gotta hang my head in shame and just say we were not ready. We were not prepared. And the samples didn't get taken. TVA shut us out. Now, they couldn't stop me in the airplane. Once again, Southwing saved our bacon because the only high-resolution photographs that came out of that site were mine, and Southwing's had me in the air 3 hours after the report hit. It was amazing. I was flying Kingston, taking photographs of it, and when we landed, my cell phone went off, and it was somebody calling and saying Widow Creek had broke. And they had me another pilot, another plane. By the time I could drive to Kingston, from Kingston to Widow Creek, Southwing had a plane and another pilot ready to go.
They do monumental work, John. They really do. They do.
Absolutely amazing people. But we got up, and when I got up there, I couldn't find where there was a breach. I looked for a dam break. I couldn't find it. But then there was this hole in the middle of the pond that kept jumping back at me. Why is that thing like that? And when we tipped the wing and I could look straight off the end of the wing, I must have taken about 50 pictures at once because it hit me all at once. That's a corrugated pipe. It has no business being there. And it sucked this pond dry.
Dang.
They knew about that one because they allowed that to happen.
Well, that was, again, that's an intentional act, John.
I think it is. To me, that is intentionally negligent act. And you know, when Kingston came out, I came out, was the first to get on camera saying this is a crime of negligence. Someone should go to jail for what happened at both of those plants. And in the same week, the Ocoee River, also inundated with ash by TVA. Three rivers in 2 weeks. It's insanity.
And we're still waiting, John. We're still waiting for the what's good. Still waiting for somebody to wake up to it, for the nation to wake up to it. Because you know this thing happened back around Christmas. And I
will say this: we've had more attention since that happened to coal combustion waste than at any time in my entire career. So this is a great door opener. No one lost their life. Unlike Buffalo Creek, no one lost their life, and that is such a blessing. It could have been a completely different scenario had this happened in the summertime, and all of those people at Swan Pond who are snowbirds and summer visitors, had they been there in their cottages and this happened, we would have seen multiple deaths. So, you know, he's looking out for us. He's giving advocates tools to work with. And if we don't seize the opportunity as advocates across this country to push the envelope and tell these sons of bitches we will, excuse me.
That's all right.
If we don't send a loud, hard message to the people in control of this country, that we want a different energy package. We want responsible energy. We want renewable energy. We want our communities left intact. We want our mountains left intact. And by God, we want to eat the fish in our rivers. We've got to do that as a collective. No politician can make that happen. I don't care how powerful they may seem. No politician is going to make that happen. No scientist is going to make that happen. No one environmentalist is going to make that happen. It's going to take every one of us as a collective, and that opportunity is knocking on our door right now.
Yes, it is. And the stakes are becoming much more plain as well, John. All the hard and dedicated work that you do, creek keepers, river keepers, water keepers, needs to be magnified and intensified. And that's like me telling you, wow, you know, we need more people doing what you're doing. It needs to be happening on a much more massive scale here in West Virginia. You and I have had brief conversations about the New and the Gauley rivers. These things are literally under attack. There's a string of mountain removal jobs that starts here in my hometown and eventually will extend all the way up into the next county, and every last one of it runs along and drains into the Gauley River. And then there's an old coal-fired power plant that supplies my electricity, sadly. Technically I buy wind power, but you know how that is. That sits hard by the Kanawha River on downstream from all of that. And we're begging for another disaster if we don't do what you're doing.
Well, you know, it's not just the mining aspect of it, Bob. There is so much involved with this myth of cleansing coal. You know, coal to liquid, supposed to be our big salvation. We can make diesel fuel out of coal. Well, okay, now we're going to double the extraction, and we're going to go get the dirtiest possible stuff out there, lignite and brown coal. And that's what we're going to squeeze the diesel fuel out of.
And we're going to use clean water and turn it into filthy water to do it.
And where are we going to put the waste?
See,
lignite and brown coal create almost three times, I've forgotten the exact statistics, but it's nearly three times the amount of waste as bituminous coal.
Yes.
So where are we going to put all of that waste? What kind of another lie are we going to create? Are we going to use it?
Well, you know, just dam up another holler. The hillbillies won't mind, John.
Well, see, there ain't no hollers where this stuff's coming from in Mississippi.
That's
my
true.
God, they're mining coal in Mississippi.
Now, that just, that beats
yeah.
all. That beats all.
And it ain't
all.
Coal to me. It's nothing but burnable dirt.
Yeah.
It's all a lie. It's a big lie. And we at Waterkeeper Alliance is the first organization. I've been dealing with this stuff for going on 2 decades now. And for the first time, Bob, I have a platform that deals with coal cradle to grave. Every facet, every aspect of coal will be brought to light. The lies will be exposed, and the truth will be told. And you can find that at www.thedirtylie.com. The reason I'm in New York City tonight, I'm going to attend a party tomorrow night, our launching party for the DirtyLie.com. Bobby Kennedy's coming into town.
Oh, mercy.
Gloria Rubin will be here, Kevin Bacon. We're going to have a party at the Green Room downtown. It's supposed to be the most environmentally friendly nightclub in at least New York. And we're going to announce thebiglie.com in a big way.
Oh, dadgummit, John, I wish I'm going to be on the road tomorrow night, but what I wouldn't do to hear from you there and get a few people on the horn to talk about the truth behind the dirty lie.
Here's how you can help me, Bob, and you can help America by doing this.
All right.
I'm going to video everything that I can tomorrow night, of course. But part of my trip, I'm going to turn this into a working trip and come back down through Appalachia. I'm going to go Saturday and Sunday over into Pennsylvania and interview some folks over in Longwall Country.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will be in D.C. for the gathering, the Greenpeace gathering at the power plant there.
We'll be there, too.
See my West by God, Virginia. I'll be wearing something with a Waterkeeper fish on it. That's a promise.
All right.
But then after that, I want to come back down through Appalachia and meet and greet with a few folks, interview them on camera, and we're going to produce YouTube link segment videos to be released periodically on the DirtyLie.com. Then I'll go out to the Four Corners area, and I'll interview some of the Hopi, the Navajo, the Zuni Pueblo.
Yeah, folks dealing with Black Mesa.
The stories that are not being told, Bob, are the ones I want to talk to. I love Larry Gibson, and everybody knows his story. I want to talk to the little lady who's sitting at her kitchen table and hadn't had her story told yet.
Well, I tell you what, on your way back down through, if we don't hook up in D.C., which I sincerely hope we do, John, you got the number here.
Yeah, give... number. Call me and we'll make arrangements. I'll find you if I have to.
All right, sounds good, and I'll give you my number as well. But I can introduce you to some people around here that would love to have their story told.
Well, you know it. It's not like it. I'm no reporter. I'm not a New York Times journalist of any kind. I just want to ask them a couple of questions and sit down and let them talk.
Yep. That's what it has to be because, these are raw stories from a rather raw existence, John. These are ignored people. You know, I mean, we just are. We're in the way of the corporate worship of holy profit.
We're the nation's energy sacrifice zone, and that sucks.
Yeah, it does. It does, and that's why I found. I don't know if you've seen it, the Van Jones remarks from the Good Jobs Green Jobs conference when he talked about turning sacrifice zones into sacred zones. Pretty inspiring stuff, and I hope to heck it can happen. He'll be speaking at Power Shift again, and I hope maybe this time I get to get him behind a microphone. You never know. But we have to start thinking that way. And the thing that I keep preaching over and over again, you cannot green the rest of America until you green Appalachia, because if you green the rest of America without greening Appalachia, every green thing you do is going to have Cole's tarry, filthy, dirty black stain all over it.
And I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
I'm sick of hearing the horror stories. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this last time. I've been doing this a long time. And I'm still fighting the same fight that I fought 20 years ago.
And every time you think you've made a little progress, along comes 8 years of some political nightmare, and everything gets thrown into reverse, and you wind up further back than when you started working the first time. I know. It eats you alive.
Well, I hope and pray that things are going to turn around with this administration. Now, don't get me wrong. Now, I am not an Obama drum beater.
Me neither.
I voted for him, I'll tell you that.
Me too.
But I still got my doubts. He's real close to the coal people for me.
Well, you know, I was off air by the time he was speaking last night, but I can guarantee you there were some words used when he said those two words, you know, the clean and the other one. When he said that last night, there were some words used I'd be ashamed for my mama to know I knew how to use. But it goes through me, John. I'm ever since we talked, I kind of paid attention, and I just can't stand to hear the phrase anymore. Drives me batty. It honestly does. I have you to thank for that. But I don't know if you heard Nanette earlier when she was talking, and the head of the West Virginia Coal Association, John, was interviewed about that two-word obscenity. And he said, when you flip on your lights and you see the light on your ceiling, that's clean coal.
Yeah.
That's what we're up against. That's what we're fighting.
Well, that's why I'm hoping the dirtylie.com, go up and look around in there. We've got videos posted, and we're going to be putting new stuff up. It's going to be a work in progress. You know, as long as we need it up there, we're going to keep it up there and refresh it with new stuff. But that, I think, Bob, that is how we're going to turn things around.
Well, I just loaded it here, and what
educate the people who are blindly flipping the switch and voting. People in New York City. People in La Jolla, California, who have never seen a coal mine and wouldn't know a coal stack if they drove by. They're the ones that have to know. And that's why we chose Manhattan to kick this party off. We're right here on Wall Street's front door. We're right here where the money brokers come and go, and we're going to open the front door to the dirtylie.com and say, by God, deal with it. You Wall Street profit jockeys cannot destroy us anymore. We are not ignorant anymore. We can do this, but like I said, it's going to take everybody. You got to participate.
That you do. And I just had a look at the website while we were talking. That's a brilliant piece of design work. That is tremendous.
Oh, and it's only going to get better. Because once I begin bringing in these raw video of the people you're going to introduce me to, my good brother Bill McCabe down in Virginia, I want to talk to some of his folks. I'm going over into Pennsylvania to interview Miriam Plovic. I don't know if you know Miriam, but she is an absolute hero in the long wall side of this thing. She stayed in her house through subsidence. They went under her. She could actually hear the machinery under her house. Her house began to subside on Christmas Day. This woman has, I've forgotten the exact numbers, but it's like 27 children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And she could not have them in her home on Christmas because the house was subsiding. They cabled her house off. They blocked all of her doors, nailed them shut, nailed her windows shut to keep it from breaking apart when it sank. They told Miriam she would have to leave. She would have to go to a motel while the house subsided. Hell no, I won't. She and her husband built that house and knew a little bit about destruction. And before subsidence began, they pulled strings through the house that were level. They hung plumb bobs from the door jams and made marks on the floor. They set levels in strategic places in the house. And they stayed. And they videotaped their house subsiding. And in parts of the video, you can see a plumb bob hanging from the door, and it's not moving at all. And all of a sudden in the video, with no wind or nothing, the plumb bob begins to move. And set a golf ball down on the floor and not thump it, just set it down and watch it roll across the floor. That's kind of hard to imagine these things, but now you're out there, you've baked cakes before, a 14-inch Pyrex baking pan.
Sure.
She baked a cake on Christmas Day that was 3/4 of an inch thick on one side, 1 3/4 inches on the other side. Her house was tilted that much. Her stove, no. The entire house had tilted
yep.
that much on Christmas Day. Those are the stories that have got to be told, Bob. People in La Jolla, California need to know. People in New York City need to know
yes.
about Miriam. They need to know about what happens when they flip these switches and go off and leave them. Like I'm standing here looking out this window from the 12th floor, looking across New York City at thousands and thousands of acres of our mountains going up in smoke.
Yeah.
Going up in smoke.
For empty buildings.
There's nobody in them. I see a few people on a couple of floors, yeah, but I mean, there's whole office, there's a whole dental facility right next to me that every light in the building's on. I can see every chair. Every chair is covered with plastic. Nobody's in the building. All the computers are turned off, and I can see this because all of the freaking lights are on.
This part of it is not rocket science, John. Turn the damn lights off. Yeah, but...
Oh, holy cow.
I know. Yeah. But what you're talking about is so vital because the query that I asked Nanette earlier in the evening, if you knew that you were doing something that was doing grave harm to another fellow human being, another American fellow human being, would you keep doing it? And most anybody with any kind of a moral sense, John, says, well, hell no, I wouldn't. Well, then turn the lights off. You know, rednecks and Appalachians and hillbillies, we are actually as American as anybody else in this country. And it's not okay to sacrifice us, our kids, our kids' futures, the places where we live. It's not okay. And frankly, I've gotten to a point where I'm kind of red-assed about it, John.
Everybody should be red-assed about it. That's the deal right there, Bob. We've got to get everybody red-assed about black cocaine. This product that America cannot get enough of has to be equated to drugs. It's something that we know is bad for us. We know that it is killing our communities, our neighbors, our neighborhoods. And yet, for that instant gratification, it's worth it. It's like cocaine.
It very much is. And it will drive you to madness and death, just like cocaine.
Well, it's got to. We got to start somewhere. And you know, for years, I'll never fault anybody for standing up for their community. We've had tremendous effort on mountaintop removal. We've had tremendous effort on longwall mining. We've got Jeff Stant up there that has just been an absolute warrior for coal ash and coal combustion waste, but they're individualized fights. And they don't really overlap each other. People in Appalachia fighting for mountaintop removal really don't know what's happening to the people out west. They don't know a whole lot about longwall mining, except in, you know, a few certain areas.
Right. But we're closing those gaps. We're closing those gaps.
Water Keeper Alliance is, you know, and we should do it. Water Keeper Alliance should be the ones to do this, because every facet of coal affects water. Nothing you can do with coal does not affect water. You mine it, you're destroying aquifers. You're polluting the streams. You're burying the streams, taking off the tops of the mountains. You're changing the weather. Then when you burn it, it goes into the air, yes, but it's redeposited there on the ground and in the water, and the toxins are ingested through the water.
And thereby comes the heart and soul of the saying that I first heard from Maria Gano up here, we're all downstream.
That's right. So who better to take something like the dirtylie.com and run it out into the public than the Water Keeper Alliance? I am so proud of this movement.
It's amazing. Since I found out about it, and you know, frankly, the first I heard about it was when I heard Bobby Kennedy speak down in the Coal River Valley, John. And it was exciting just to hear the kind of activism that was building around the organization, and then to hear the fire and passion that you bring to it. I know the validity of the work that's being done, and I know the force and impact that it's having. And this next step with thedirtylie.com, like I said, this is a stunningly gorgeous website, sharp as a tack, and it will get seen and it will get noticed. This movement just to get the cities to turn the daggum lights. You know, I bark at my children when they walk out of their bedroom and leave the light on, and an entire city does it?
Yeah.
Who's,
well, you'll find, and you know, you and I have talked a little bit about, and we will talk some more about the potential for a Water Keeper program on the New or the Gauley. But if you associate yourself with Water Keepers, you'll find that the passion that I bring to this movement is not singular. Most of my brother and sister water keepers are just as passionate, if not more so, than I am. And that's why I think that we're the right ones to bring this out. Not saying that the others are, you know, that other groups are not having a significant impact. Everybody needs to focus on their individual things and take care of mountaintop removal, because that's your backyard.
Yeah. That's our home.
But at the same time, we got to look at the whole package.
We've got to look outside. Right. We got to look outside the
doing to us cradle to grave.
Precisely. And you know, I've been beaten on this little quote that was sent along to us by our buddy Reverbo a while back, and I got to send it along to you in a Facebook message or something, John. A little excerpt from a Kurt Vonnegut book from 1973. It'll blow you away. And the other thing, I appreciate you putting up the Country Roads parody video that we had. I saw you did that over at Facebook. That was awful cool. And I just checked, that thing's up over 3,000 views now. It jumped 500 between yesterday and today.
Yeah. Well, you remember where that came from? I think this one may have been reworked a little bit. But Ken Heckler actually sang that on the floor of the Congress. He got up before Congress and used his time and sang either those words or very similar, but he got up and sang that in the Congress.
Well, I didn't know he had. I just I heard the phrase almost level and ran off and wrote the lyrics. And
okay, then I thought those lyrics sounded a little different.
Yeah, that's just something I threw together about 4 years ago.
Oh, man, okay. Well, now there was another version of it that he actually sang on the floor of the Congress.
I'll be darned. I wonder if there's a recording of that. I'd love to find it.
Been all over YouTube and you know, tried to Google it up, and I can't find it. But I do know there was some VHS tape of it, and maybe Obed has a copy.
Well, I'll look around and see if I can find it, because I'd love to honor Ken for his earlier work, because no one has worked harder than him, and you know what you know, he defines the word hero around here. You know, up in his 90s, and you know, still standing up, and you know, getting attacked by the coal mob, and doesn't care.
And whoa, Heckler's in his 90s.
Oh yeah.
Okay, I'm mistaking him for somebody else. There was another congressman from West Virginia who sang that song in the House, in the Congress. It wasn't Heckler.
Okay.
The guy that sang it was younger. He was younger than that. And this was, I want to say 89.
Hmm.
But his went on, it was almost level, West Virginia. No. Strip my mountains, pushed them in the valleys. And it went on. But yours, I knew when I heard it, those lyrics were different. That was good. I like that. Life is cheaper by the ton.
Yeah, and we lose more by law here than if they used a gun. You know, we had that all just came to the forefront two Fridays ago when that Fourth Circuit decision came down, John. And now we're finding out that the mine companies are absolutely knocking down the DEP's doors, trying to get permits to do more. Since there's been somewhat of a moratorium on it while the court case was pending, but now it's Katie bar the door.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, please say hello to everybody that needs a hello said to them from the horn tomorrow night. Best of luck, John, with the launch of the website. And it sounds like you've got people there that are gonna start spreading the word and get people to turn the daggum lights out and understand that stuff can't be, clean cocaine. There you go.
Black cocaine.
Yep. Exactly.
Well, there is hope. And, you know, another thing that I'm here to kind of celebrate, and I do want to pass this on. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled in our favor last Friday against Tuscaloosa Resources Incorporated, a coal mine in my watershed. The case was more against the state than against the CONC because of improper permitting like what y'all are dealing with here in West Virginia. The stream was on the 303D list, the EPA's list of impaired streams.
Mm-hmm.
And I argued that because of that, it precluded any further permitting of those pollutants. And the state disagreed with me. They issued the permits anyway. I now have a whole buttload of permits in my watershed that were opened that way. The Supreme Court just ruled in our favor. They overthrew the permit. Now I have legal precedent to go back and reopen every coal mine permit in my watershed. We are the only environmental organization in Alabama's history to ever reverse a coal mine permit every appeal. We had 14 judges ruled in our favor. Not one judge ruled against us.
Dadgum. That is... And for people who don't know the Alabama judicial system, they don't really know how huge that is.
There is hope, my brother. If I can do that with limited finances in a state like Alabama, under the Alabama Department of Environmental Maniacs, it can be done in other places. You just got to be persistent. You've got to have that bulldog attitude.
Never give up.
That's it. You cannot. If you ever let them have a little bit of headway, they'll walk all over you. And together, everybody will develop just a little bit more tenacity. If we'll all go after this, we can expose the big lie, and we can turn this thing around in the next decade.
Well, I got a feeling that website will be getting a lot of play, John. And I
sure hope so. We sure put a lot into it if it don't.
Oh, my God. That's obvious how much got put into it. Now, I guess the last thing we need to have stop happening I guess you noticed that your attorney general has decided that he's got a dog in the hunt up in Washington in this corrupt coal court case that's before the Supreme Court, haven't you?
Yeah, but let me ask you something. How did he get to be my attorney general?
Well, yeah, you didn't vote for him. I know. I was just needling a little bit.
Yeah.
But I guess
some uphill battles. And it's not going to change overnight, but it's never going to change if we don't all work on it together.
There you go. Absolutely right. Well, enjoy your stay in New York City, John, and best of luck with the launch. And I'll be back in touch with you post-show, and we'll swap phone numbers and stuff so we can try to hook up in D.C.
All right. God bless you for what you do, Bob. You are the voice that we have to have.
Well, thank you, John. Bless your heart. And I tell you what, this is a level of activism that is exciting and energizing to hear about. So
we're going to rock some folks' world in the next decade. I guarantee it. Waterkeeper is going to be right there pushing the tide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, take care and be well. And we'll talk soon.
All right. Night, Bob.
See you, John. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
Bye. Hurricane Creek Keeper, John Wathan from Alabama, presently in New York City to do some activism, do some community organizing, do some attitude changing, and go look at thedirtylie.com. What a website. Holy cow. And if you haven't figured out, it's 15 minutes past 9 o'clock here on the East Coast, and we've gone to extra innings. And if a ball happens to land in the stands, it's yours to keep. I will not leave a phone blinking. Let's march through and see what's going on. Hey, welcome. Nope, doggone it. And let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, Koss, what's up?
Not much. That other line was me. The phone died while I was waiting.
Oh, sorry.
So I had a... stick the other one in the...
Yeah, but you at least know the drill. You know, what
yeah.
We'll have the conversations. Just takes a little patience.
Well, that's no problem. Fun listening to people.
What's happening?
Not much. I have to admit, though, I was a little bit surprised last night. I mean, after 8 years of verbal incontinence, bumper stickers and sheer nonsense. It's amazing to listen to somebody who can actually string two sentences together and make sense.
Yeah, it is, and that hasn't worn off yet. It's still refreshing just to hear somebody that can use the language. And when you compare it with what we got after Cossack, for heaven's sakes,
oh,
you
know, God. Oh God!
You know, it's like going from literally the President of the United States to Mr. Rogers. And that's not fair to Mr. Rogers, because he was well-intended, and Piyush Jindal is not well-intended.
No. No, he's not. It's just, this is the Republican Party. This is the Republican answer. More tax cuts for the rich. Excuse me, we've been doing this at least 8 years. If your theory was correct, why are we all rich? Why is the economy collapsing?
Right, and
do you understand?
Well, but they know they're lying. Like I said, this is showing up at the cocktail party you really don't want to go to. They know they're in the wilderness. They know they're irrelevant, but they have to keep at it because even though they're in the political wilderness, Cossack, they've got things that they still aim to accomplish and hope to accomplish. You know, the conversation I had with John there, just because there's a Democrat in the White House doesn't mean that the toxic polluters, the toxifiers of this country, the black cocaine pushers and or what have you, are going to give up. No, they're just going to start giving some of their money over to places they weren't giving it before and hope they can buy. Because, you know, they don't do democracy, Cossack. They do kleptocracy. They do oligarchy.
Yeah.
And they buy and sell governments on a whim.
I don't know. I'm just at a loss. We plus the fact we have what 29% of the population that still supported that jackass to the bitter end and are still out there. The Joe the Plumber pipes.
Aye.
I mean, if you're making less than $250,000 a year and you're voting Republican, you are a chicken that is voting for Colonel Sanders.
Yes, you are.
And there are so many. I walk out of the door every day and get to listen to these idiots.
And it's a little frustrating. Yeah, because you're kind of in the heart of it.
and how? I mean, when I've talked to people and suggest things like cheat, we really could do with, you know, a 25% to 50% cut in the military budget. You would have thought that I had said that we should barbecue their grandmother.
That sounds about right.
You know. Oh, but we need all these weapons. What for? Who are you going to fight with them? You're going to hunt down the Mujahideen in Afghanistan with an F-35? Are you insane? Most expensive plane in the world that is useless for what we're doing? Where's the thought process here?
And you know, it's inspiring to know that we're maybe finally on the way out of Iraq. But we still got to answer that Afghanistan question, Cossack.
Oh yeah. Well. Again, I do not understand how people are so limited in their thought processes. If Alexander the Great could not conquer Afghanistan, if the British, in two tries, the British Empire couldn't conquer Afghanistan, if the Soviet Union, with, what, three times the number of troops that we have in there, couldn't defeat Afghanistan, what the hell are we going to do?
I don't know, because I don't sit around thinking that I'm smarter than Alexander.
And,
but there's somebody in the Pentagon who thinks that. No kidding.
Oh, no. And the Russians have been trying to tell these people, listen, you're not going to win. You can't do what we couldn't do. It's just not going to happen. And if it does, your country is going to collapse. It's going to suck out so many resources that your people can buy it. Do you understand?
No, we could do it. You guys are just incompetent.
Okay. Yeah. We'll see. We're not listening.
And
we listen to no one.
But, you know, look, 30 years from now, everybody gets to, Afghanistan gets to be Vietnam.
Exactly.
And we'll do like food travel shows that are there, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, you've read that interview that Brzezinski had with the French magazine back in 1998, where he actually admitted that, well, yeah, the Russians really were right. We actually were in Afghanistan 6 months before they came in. We just wanted to give them their Vietnam. And they, Brzezinski, was funding what? Those few crazy, quote, fundamentalist Muslims.
Freedom fighters. No, quit that. They were freedom fighters, Cossack. They were freedom fighters.
Yeah. Up until he crashed into the Twin Towers.
Well, we hate to talk about that.
Yeah. These are the people that we funded. You know, when you train a pit bull to attack, you can't complain when it chews up your kid.
There you go.
You know? Yeah. You know, and he even said in his interview, you know, what's more important to the world? Yeah, a few stirred up Muslims or the downfall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you ask the survivors? Why don't you ask the families of those people that died? Ask them which was more important. And we still can't understand that there is such a thing as blowback. They're not...
Now, I don't think... No. Wait, Casa. I don't think it's that we can't understand it. There's lots of people, obviously, we're talking about it, we get it. There are people who are willfully in denial of it.
Right.
Because if you allow for a concept like blowback, then you have to start dealing with sort of karmic or universal retributive justice. And nobody can ever admit that, maybe we're earning some of this stuff gets earned.
I mean, they don't, quote, hate us for our freedoms. No. They hate us for our policies.
And they hate us for our negligence, and they hate us for our holier-than-thouness, and they hate us for a variety of reasons. Look, nobody wants to admit it. Well, no right-winger, no so-called conservative, no. They don't want to admit that the seeds that bore the fruit of September 11th, 2001, were sown in the Reagan administration.
Oh, yeah. Easily. I mean, well, unfortunately, there was sown during the Carter administration.
Yeah, some of them, too. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know. The problem of, well, and if we want to really follow the logic back to its beginnings.
You remember the fit that people threw when Jimmy Carter said we weren't going to the Moscow Olympics?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, you're politicizing the beauty of athletics. Now, Jimmy Carter, to his credit, at least saw the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan as arguably a human rights issue.
Yeah, but, again, was it an invasion?
True.
We say that we didn't invade Iraq. We were invited.
Right,
invited to stay there all these years. You know? Which is a crock. You knew that, and I know that. The Afghans certainly didn't invite us. And if you remember, back when, this was in 2002, before we attacked Afghanistan, the Taliban said, hey, you know, show us some evidence that bin Laden was behind this, and we'll turn him over to an international tribunal for trial. No, we'd actually rather invade, thank you. You know, this is how insane this.
It is. It's insane.
They were willing to give the guy up without a shot being fired. And today we've killed far more civilians in Afghanistan, wedding parties, than we have Taliban or Mujahideen.
Although I found it interesting that reaction out of Pakistan was largely, I guess, officially favorable to the president's remarks last night. Did you catch that?
No.
That they thought it was described as a more reasonable and rational approach than what had been engaged in thus far. Of course, to me, the only reasonable and rational approach to Afghanistan is get the hell out.
Yeah.
Everything else is literally founded upon irrationality and avoidance of reason.
Right. And I mean, you know, again, how intelligent is this? We're sitting there and we've admitted that we're launching these predators, the drones, from Pakistan, and we're firing missiles from Nellis Air Force Base. And just how discriminating do you really think that is? You can actually tell that there's a Taliban in that house and not a family?
Oh, I was listening to public radio the other day, Cossack, and I'm glad you mentioned this. And I heard an interview with an artist, and this is one of those gee, I love art moments. The man is an Iraqi, and his brother... And this was all about an art project that he had done. His brother was killed in a drone missile attack in Iraq. His brother was not a terrorist.
No.
His brother was a guy who got in the way of the American munitions industry. And so the surviving brother, who is an artist, is in America, and he starts doing research on how that came to be, and he finds out that somebody with a joystick sitting in a room in Colorado killed his brother.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, is utterly remorseless about it. Because there's a, you know, there's that institutional psychological thing that allows people to avoid responsibility. Frankly, it's the same psychological phenomenon that allows people to leave lights on in skyscrapers in New York City without thinking of the 70 acres of West Virginia Appalachian Mountain that gets blown up to keep those lights on in buildings that don't have any people in them.
Exactly.
But to turn back toward my gist of what I was saying. So the guy turns around and creates an art project, and he constructs a clear dwelling space. He lives in it for 30 days, and every angle in that clear living space is on camera. It was literally a living art project. Everything can be seen. And he put a paintball gun aimed into the room with yellow paintballs, and they could be operated by people accessing the art project on the internet. And people, lots and lots of Americans and people from other places in the world just had a fun time, just, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, shoot him anytime you want to, just shooting him remotely, just like they shot his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because eventually a peace movement developed in the project. And that was people who figured out that they could sit there and watch and wait for somebody to try to shoot and then try to control the gun themselves and make them miss. Fascinating study. Fascinating piece of artwork. But again, it's that question of stuff that we willfully do not wish to examine. And whether it is in the context of war or in the context of how we treat American communities, Kosak.
Yeah.
It's a matter of getting up in people's faces and forcing them to confront it. And then it's not, then you can't walk away so easily anymore.
No. It's like I've written about several times about, like, the Stanford Prison Project. Abu Ghraib had to happen just on the basis of what they found in the Stanford Project. You remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
You know, within just a couple of days, even though everybody knew that everybody else was a college student just like them, the guards were abusing the prisoners. The prisoners started to revolt. They had to shut the damn project down in something like 6 days. It was planned for a month. The problem of it is when you put people in positions of power, they will abuse it.
Yeah, as long as they have some sort of an out. Exactly.
Yeah. As long as somebody says, oh, it's okay.
Yeah, you're forgiven, you're absolved, you have governmental immunity, the government is behind you. As long as that's a function of, and we could do 3 hours on this, Cossack. That's a function of the authoritarian mindset that has been studied, and it comes out with some very, very creepy conclusions. Cossack, I've got to run along. I ran over and everything, but I enjoyed the call, and frankly, I gotta shut this all down and get packing, literally packing, because I got to get up early and get going tomorrow.
Yeah, that's true.
But take care, and I hope we'll hear from you again soon.
You will.
All right. Good to see you. Good to hear from you tonight, and always good to see you in the room, Cossack.
All righty. You take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy the Cossack, a regular in the Head On Radio Network chat room and also resident knower of lyrics, resident knower of lots of stuff, calling in from what you wouldn't exactly call the liberal bastion of North Florida. So that's it for the program this evening. Thanks everybody, and hope you didn't mind the extra innings with a conversation like what we had with John Watham going there. I just knew we had to run over. Just a reminder, probably no show tomorrow night. Maybe a show Friday. If God willing, the creek don't rise, that'd be very nice. And we'll try to be doing some stuff over the weekend, and I'll send out some emails so other people can send out some emails. And I hope that the media stuff works out there, and we get to bring you some of the conference itself, not me babbling about the conference, but make it real to people who couldn't make it to D.C. That's so very important as we go forward in these endeavors. Using our powers for good. There you go. So thanks for your calls, your emails. Thanks for your participation in the chat room. Don't forget to go by the headonradionetwork.com forum and post your thoughts there, post stories, engage in conversation during the time when programming isn't live on the horn. Thanks to everybody who helps keep things going here at the Horn via your kind contributions. We would not be able to do this without you. Thank you, and it is an honor to know what the Horn means to you, because the time you share with us means so very, very much. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. Between listener contributions and the network sponsorship from Coal River Mountain Watch, it's what makes this all go. And, of course, the work, as you heard John Watham talking about, the work that gets done is world-changing, and it is a change for the better. And so much of what I've learned, so much of the inspiration, has come through Coal River Mountain Watch, and truly they are my heroes. They are the hardest-working, bravest people I know. And they are all standing there upstream, not giving up one inch of ground, because they know that we are all, in fact, downstream. Thanks to John Fox, web designer, musician, host of All Foxed Up with John Fox, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I assume John will be live this Sunday evening. We will certainly find out. Just be there Sunday evening, 9 o'clock. Join us on the weekend schedule in general. Night Sounds with Billy Shears, Rick's Place with Horn Psychotherapist Rick Goodner, and The Rick Smith Show, all on the weekend schedule, doing all this because I don't know if I'm going to be on the air Friday to remind you. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. All of what Peter does is so amazing, keeping all these computers in line and behaving. Another one of those vital little linchpins in how the Horn continues to exist. And then, of course, there is the hardest working, most overworked man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, who literally saved talk radio on the Internet starting in 2002 with WhiteRoseSociety.org. Every bit, every packet that passes through the stream passes through the infrastructure that Ben Birch has built at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, last night, Barack Obama, the President of the United States, sounds so good to say that, President Barack Obama gave what some might call a State of the Union speech. Now, it wasn't technically a State of the Union speech, and that's because technically a State of the Union speech is given, well, at the end of a year. And but President Obama, like President Bush, President Clinton, and President Bush before him, decided to lay out his agenda at the beginning of the year, even though it was the year he came into office. So the Constitution says that the president shall from time to time give information to Congress on the State of the Union. It actually doesn't even have to be an annual address. But really the tradition goes back to the days of the British Parliament, when the sovereign, the king, the queen, later on the prime minister, would give their address as to what they expect to happen for the coming year. Today, the queen reads the prime minister's agenda, but it's sort of the same thing. That happened in George Washington, John Adams' administration. Thomas Jefferson thought it was a little too regal. He put it in writing. He continued in writing all the way to Woodrow Wilson, who brought it back in public. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt was really the first president to bring it back every year, starting with his 1934 State of the Union Address. And he was the first to bring it before a joint House of Congress again and make it the somewhat of a spectacle that it is today. And indeed, I think President Obama's speech, well, rivaled those of FDR. President Obama, like President Roosevelt, tried to comfort a nation, to let us know we would get out of this economic mess we're in and make it stronger than ever. And that's important. It's important not just because we shouldn't have Americans lose hope, but because part of that hope and confidence is necessary to sustain the economy. President Obama made big arguments, bold arguments. He made the argument that government can work. And what's fascinating is that the American people seem to agree. During the Reagan era, probably even during the early years of Bush Jr.'s reign, American people didn't think government could succeed. They tended to believe in things like business. Well, not anymore. Today, 70%+, depending on what poll you review, believe that President Barack Obama has a good plan to help lead us out of this depression. That President Obama's stimulus package and his proposals are the ones to get us out of the economic danger we're in. Business is approved by only 30%. And while some may disagree with the stimulus package, you know, it's about 64% for that particular package, what percentage of Americans agreed with the Republican solution? The solution of only tax cuts, that's all? 10%. 10%. 10% is less than the approval rating of outgoing Vice President Dick Cheney. He always at least managed to make it to the teens. Bush would make it sometimes to the low 30s or the high 20s. 10%. And I think it was very clear the off note, the really jarring, I think, way the Republicans are viewed in the United States by listening to the response by Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, which seemed absolutely off note, like he was talking in a different universe at a different time and frankly trying to explain things to small children. We'll get to Governor Jindal's response, but I want to go through President Obama's speech. And I also want to encourage you, this is a really good day to call in, and let me know what you thought of either President Obama's State of the Union, quote-unquote, speech, or Governor Jindal's response. The number, as you know, is 877-4HEAD-ON. 877-443-2366, so you can call on your own dime, 304-658-3333. I'd like to know your impressions as I share mine, so please don't hesitate to call. My impressions are that this is a president who's hitting the ground running, who isn't backing off his campaign pledges, which include the somewhat contradictory notion of pursuing a good liberal agenda, one that most of us here support, things like moving us closer to universal health care, providing jobs for people, giving us a green economy, getting us off of our dependence on foreign oil, helping kids get a good education all the way through college, and so forth. And combining it with the idea of reaching out to Republicans. Now, President Obama campaigned on both themes, on the themes of what he said he would do. Clearly, he is attempting those. But also reaching out to the other side to listen to them and possibly incorporate their good ideas. And at the time, I said that those ideas can be contradictory. You can be pushed, if particularly if the Republicans stand firm, as they seem to be standing firm now, the great majority of them, into either giving up your ideals in the name of bipartisanship or giving up bipartisanship in the name of ideals. But I think President Obama so far has managed to thread that needle quite nicely. Here's what he does. He says, here's our plan. He goes to the Republicans and says, do you have any additions? Do you have any cooperative ideas? Do you have any suggestions? He listens. He takes the good ones. And if they don't support it, well, then they're off the boat. They're off the bus. But yet, every day, he welcomes them on the bus again if they want to be. Now, this isn't the take it or leave it of a George W. Bush or even a Ronald Reagan. But what it is at least a willingness to listen. And I don't think that's ever a bad idea, even when it's, God forbid, Republicans. It's never a bad idea to listen. Every now and then, they might even have a good idea. But President Obama began his speech by saying something I've never heard any president say before, at least not in my recollection. The first thing he said after, you know, Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, and the First Lady of the United States. The first words he said were, I've come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women in this great chamber, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. That was a really nice touch, I thought. Not, I'm speaking to the people of America, we know that, but to the men and women who sent us here. Obama seems to recognize that we are the bosses of the President of the United States and the members of Congress. He wants to speak to the boss, the American people, the men and women who sent us here. I don't recall President Bush using that kind of language or recognizing that he owed a duty to the people who sent him here. Maybe that's because they were just five members of the United States Supreme Court. But President Obama goes on to talk about why we are where we are. And I want to play a somewhat extended clip from near the beginning of his speech as he explains why we are where we are. Because I think he nicely ties together fixing the economy, which is, of course, essential, with all the long-term problems we've had for a long time. Things like energy and health care. And education, things like lack of regulation. Because President Obama understands that this economy is not a short-term problem. Sure, we've got to fix the immediate recession we're in, but that we can do so while fixing the long-term problems at the same time. Yes, you can do two things at once. Remember when John McCain said, oh, no, I can't do a debate right now. I've got to run home and save the economy to support the bank bailout package. And President Obama, then Senator Obama, said, now, wait a minute, you can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can do lots of things at the same time. A president has to be able to do more than one thing at once, and this is a president doing lots of things at once. I'm not giving credit for it. Let me play for you President Obama's discussion of how we got where we are today.
The fact is, our economy did not fall into decline overnight, nor did all of our problems begin when the housing market collapsed or the stock markets sank. We have known for decades that our survival depends on finding new sources of energy, yet we import more oil today than ever before. The cost of health care eats up more and more of our savings each year. Yet we keep delaying reform. Our children will compete for jobs in a global economy that too many of our schools do not prepare them for. And though all of these challenges went unsolved, we still managed to spend more money and pile up more debt, both as individuals and through our government, than ever before. In other words, we have lived through an era where too often short-term gains were prized over long-term prosperity, where we failed to look beyond the next payment, the next quarter, or the next election. The surplus became an excuse to transfer wealth to the wealthy instead of an opportunity to invest in our future. Regulations were gutted for the sake of a quick profit at the expense of a healthy market. People bought homes they knew they couldn't afford from banks and lenders who pushed those bad loans anyway. And all the while, critical debates and difficult decisions were put off for some other time on some other day. Well, that day of reckoning has arrived, and the time to take charge of our future is here. Now is the time to act boldly and wisely.
So you see what he's doing here. He's making clear, hey, you know, I know this may be called the Obama Depression by Republicans in 5 years, but our economy didn't fall into decline overnight. We've known about the energy problem a long time. We've known about the healthcare problem a long time. We've known about education problems a long time. We have been in short-term government rather than long-term. And it's not just a Republican thing. Sure, that was George Bush. I would argue that Bill Clinton had that idea, too. Short-term fixes was the best we could do. Bill Clinton did try in his first 2 years in office when the Democrats controlled Congress. Hillary Clinton tried to do a big health care fix. And it seemed that when that failed, so took the sails out of a lot of Clinton's big ideas. He did lots of small things that were good. But the big ideas went by the wayside, and they did because, let's face it, it's much easier to sell a short-term fix than a long-term fix. A long-term fix causes people to worry about problems for the future. They worry about, socialized medicine, or they worry about changes to anything that's the way they're used to it. They don't want to get cars that don't guzzle gas. What's an electric car? They never had one. They don't know how it works. How would you fill it up? Change is scary. But in times of great economic distress, change is a lot easier. I mean, a depression is opportunity. Many of our best government programs began in the New Deal, in a time of our greatest economic crisis. And President Barack Obama understands that crisis is opportunity, that he has opportunities that even Bill Clinton didn't have, because the country was not in a crisis. I love just the way he says, a surplus became an excuse to transfer wealth to the wealthy instead of an opportunity to invest in our future. You know, instead of talking about the Bush tax cuts, we should just say transferring wealth to the wealthy. The Bush wealth transfer to the wealthy. That has a nice ring to it. He talks about regulations being gutted. He also talks about people and their own individual decisions, making clear that, we all have responsibility too. It seems that the Republicans only point that out, but it is a fair point. Individuals have responsibility. The government has responsibility. Anyway, he goes on to say that he wants his plans, not because he believes in big government, but because, and not because he's not mindful of the debt, but because a failure to act would have worsened the debt. It's amazing to me how the Republicans are newly created deficit hawks. The same Republican Congress that had the largest earmarks in American history, the largest deficit in American history, the largest wasteful spend in American history, including, my personal favorite, $13 billion dollars in cash lost in Iraq. Oops. $12 billion in cash. That's a lot of cash. I think Bob once told me it was like 10 or 11 tractor-trailer trucks. But there were no complaints about that. Now they're deficit hawks. hawks, and there's a reason why they are now deficit hawks. They're deficit hawks because when the Democrats are in control of government, they might use the government to do some good. They might use the government for things other than wars, other than corporate welfare, other than pork. And so now Republicans say, well, we want smaller government. Trust us, we want smaller government. That is never the case, ever. Republicans don't want smaller government. They want different government. They want government that reaches out to different interests. But it's all about trying to put one over on the American people. It's all about, there's nothing to see here, move along. Don't look when President Barack Obama says that 95% of working Americans will get a tax cut. We're going to call that a tax increase. Even though Obama said, and I love the way he said this, he said, we're only increasing taxes on those that earn $250,000 a year. And he said, and let me get the exact quote up here. I have it somewhere here. It's hard to jump around with all this. Here it is. Let me be perfectly clear, because I know you'll hear the same old claims that rolling back these tax breaks means a massive tax increase on the American people. If your family earns less than $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year, you will not see your taxes increased a single dime. I repeat, not one single dime. In fact, the recovery plan provides a tax cut. That's right, a tax cut for 95% of working families. And these checks are on the way. I think the American people have finally figured out that the Republicans are putting one over on them. I think we've got it. I really think we've got it, most of us. Because later on, when Governor Bobby Jindal says, he wants tax increases, it fell like a lead balloon. Going on with the speech, one of the things that I was glad he did was explain why we are giving money to the banks. And even admitting very clearly that he knows that no one wants to give any more money to the banks. That he understands why people are angry at the banks for ruining our economy and don't want to help the people that put us in that terrible shape. And he does talk about holding the executives accountable. But he also points out the necessity of credit. You may not like your banker. You shouldn't like your banker, but banks themselves perform a necessary and important function. And they do. The flow of credit, President Obama said, is the lifeblood of our economy. The ability to get a loan is how you finance the purchase of everything from a home to a car to a college education. How stores stock their shelves, farms buy equipment, and businesses make payroll. But credit has stopped flowing the way it should. Too many bad loans from the housing crisis have made their way onto the books of too many banks. With so much debt and so little confidence, these banks are now fearful of lending out any more money to households, to businesses, or to each other. When there is no lending, families can't afford to buy homes or cars, so businesses are forced to make layoffs. Our economy suffers even more, and credit dries up even further. I remember myself being skeptical of giving money to the banks, and then I listened to the words of my old boss, Congressman Barney Frank, and he persuaded me that it's a necessary evil. It's a necessary evil. Not to give money to the CEOs. I just assume they're all fired and living under a bridge with some homeless people. But to give money to the banks, not because I love the banks, but because they are the lifeblood of the economy. Kevin's on the line from New York City. Kevin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. What did you think of the speech last night?
I thought it was excellent. I was discussing with Bob that I almost feel sorry for Jindal, but... I don't know, keep on running the same joke, you know.
I'm going to play some of Jindal's speech as well and talk about him in the latter part of this hour. To me, it was it was, I can say you almost feel sorry for him. It was such a sad contrast that actually it provided me some laughter. I mean, I really enjoyed laughing at some of the things he had to say. But, this is the rising star of the Republican Party. Yikes.
The party's in trouble. You know, the party.
Clearly, if this is the best they have to offer, that's pretty sad. I actually expected to do much better. I mean, he's unlike
the Republican Party as we know it ended yesterday.
Well, you know, I mean, George Bush, Sarah Palin, these are not intelligent people. But Bobby Jindal is an intelligent person.
But
he couldn't give a better speech than that. I mean, he couldn't do it.
But the point I wanted to get to, what this country has failed to do for the past nearly 30 years is invest in wealth-building apparatus.
In wealth-building.
Yes. And
be more specific. What are you talking about? Education, healthcare, energy, something else?
Building roads and this whole privatization stuff need to get off the map, because no individual should own a bridge for the public.
I'll tell you something. No, I agree with you. I'll tell you something. One of the things that really impressed me, and I don't think many people saw this, but it's worth your time to watch, was President Obama's conference. It was kind of like a press conference. It happened on Monday. It was during the day. Like I said, I don't know too many people saw it. It was the weirdest thing, and I looked it up. This is when he gave kind of like a press conference to members of Congress. I'd never seen that before. I looked it up. Apparently it hasn't been done since Bill Clinton did it in 1997. I guess that's why I didn't remember it. It never happened to George Bush. After he had his conference, he brought it public, and he called on members of Congress to make comments and ask him questions. And the first person he called on was John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
He even called on Eric Cantor. And, of course, he called on Democrats, too. Anyway, in that conference, there was a person who stood up, and I think it was a Democrat, but it could have been a Republican. I'm really not sure, who talked exactly about what you're talking about, Kevin, about taking away this privatization, that it just hasn't worked. And President Obama seemed to support that.
Yeah, and this is how we build. You have to understand, during World War II, what did we target in Germany? Bridges, tunnels, things that produce wealth.
Yeah, okay. Basic infrastructure. And it's not just physical infrastructure, it's things like broadband. You know, the physical that are essential.
Yeah. This stuff generates wealth. Even our educational system. You know, the first thing they cut is arts and music programs. That stuff generates wealth.
I think it has value apart from wealth. No, you think art and music generates wealth? I mean, maybe,
yes,
I don't mean to.
Does.
I mean, I think it generates well-being.
You know what generates wealth? Okay, you got to go back to Adam Smith's principle of taking something that's worth, manipulating it till it's worth something. Take a stick in the middle of the road, carve it, polish it, it becomes axe handle or a cane.
Okay.
Now it's worth something.
Okay.
And that's what generates. And artists think on, you know, they take things that are perceived worthless.
Okay.
And make it into something that people would
buy. I got you. They take an empty canvas and they take a bunch of paint that's valued at $5 and they can create a thousands of dollars paint.
Exactly.
All right. I'll grant you that.
And there has to be a little bit of emphasis on those mechanisms, a bit more. I'm not saying the whole, but you understand my big picture in all this.
Oh, I do. I mean, one of the things I really liked about the speech, first of all, I liked its optimistic tone. I think that, frankly, at the time of inauguration, I have to say, I was out there, you know, with 2 million of my closest friends listening in person to our newly inaugurated president. I felt the tone was kind of down, frankly, and I don't usually criticize Obama's speeches, but I thought this speech last night was much better than his inauguration speech. Now, maybe he was trying at the beginning to, you know, gird us for the recognition that 2009 is going to be a tough year. Maybe so. But you could only keep us depressed for so long. To me, it was the speech last night that was much more Rooseveltian, much more we have nothing to fear but fear itself. You've got to instill confidence in the American people. We have the lowest consumer confidence than probably at any time since the Great Depression. And I was actually glad to see just the entire optimistic tone of the speech. And that also made Governor Jindal's response seem so flat, because he talked about, you know, Obama not being optimistic. And yet this is one of the most optimistic speeches Obama has given since he's been president of the United States.
Well, I think what it is also, that was his very first moment of being president. You know, you kind of need to grow into the part. Give him some slack on that.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen. You know, I'm trying to call it as it is. I don't want to. Obama's not my messiah. I'm not going to say everything he does is perfect. But I did think that last night's speech was even better than his inauguration speech, because he drew it all together. He just brought it all together: the economy and the long term goals. The idea of you know, we do have to care about the deficit, but in order to have a smaller deficit now, we actually need to spend more money now, which sounds counterintuitive, but actually it makes sense, because once the economy gets rolling again, more tax money comes in and so forth. And even when he said, you know, it's not about helping banks, it's about helping people, because that's a tough sell. The majority of the American people, understandably, are saying, stop giving money to the banks. We need it. And he had to explain that the counterintuitive notion, but I think he's accurate, that, yeah, you got to give money to the banks, whether you like them or not. Not to the CEOs, he spoke very badly about them, but to the institutions, because, you know, the credit is lifeblood of the American people.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where, again, like you said, banks, and I think this could be like a whole reformation of credit and a whole credit and bankruptcy and all that. I think a lot of people who are, because you have to understand, like our generation has been kind of blackmailed. We really have.
What do you mean by
that? But in the form of student loans, you know, we've been kind of pressed into slavery.
Meaning because of the debt?
Yeah.
Personal
and
debt.
There has to be a bottom out situation. Put it this way, when George Bush Sr. went to Yale, he went on a GI Bill.
Sure.
They gave him the money to go to Yale.
But actually, George Bush Sr. probably had plenty of money from his father, Senator Prescott Bush, but others of his generation did.
It was more influence on money. He went to Yale on a GI Bill.
Did he? I didn't know that. I assumed he came from a very rich family.
He did come from a very rich family, but regardless of how wealthy you are, if the college is willing to let you in for free instead of spending what was considered a lot of money back then, a couple of $1,000 per semester, you're going to go in.
One of the things I really liked about what he said is that we need to revamp our education system, and that this actually produces wealth, as you say, for the future. I thought one of his strongest points was when he talked about the fact that, you know, that we created solar technology. But the batteries are made in Korea. Germany and Japan are producing it more than we are. China is making the larger effort in clean renewable. In other words, we create this stuff, and then other countries run away with it because we're not producing it.
Well, it's the television set. You know, bring it back home to the television set. We invented it. Japan mastered it.
Exactly. Go ahead.
And, you know, come on. Japan built its empire over Sony. They couldn't do it with machine guns, so they did it over Sony and Mitsubishi and Hitachi and the rest of those.
Well, I just liked the way he brought it all together in a way that was very positive. It was interesting. It was a prescription for bold government, not big government. I mean, it was a prescription for recognizing that the private sector does the work, but that it needs government help to do that,
whether it is
education or it's infrastructure or it's healthcare or it's energy. These are all ways that the government can help Americans solve their own problems. And that's, I think, one reason why Bobby Jindal's response afterwards was so flat, because he was saying, you know, only individuals can help their own problems. And President Obama wasn't saying individuals can't solve their own problems. He was just saying that sometimes you need some government help. And this is a time when polls show, and I don't know that polls have ever shown, what they're showing now. 70% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing? Have we ever seen polls that high?
Screwed us.
30% trust business? Have we ever seen that number so low?
Well, those who trust business, it's within their interest to trust business, or they're just so far gone because they've been listening to the same gospel, false gospel for 30 years.
But, Kevin, I would bet you, and I don't have these numbers, but I would bet that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, 20, 25 years ago, from the Reagan era all the way up through the first 5 years of George Bush Jr.,
mm-hmm.
that more people would trust business than would trust the government. I think this is a real thing.
Well, the thing is, 5 years ago, people haven't suffered enough.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's my point. My guess is that the polls of trusting government versus trusting business have not been this high since the Great Depression.
Yeah. They were probably 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were doing rather well.
Sure. Oh, 2099.
20 years ago.
Sure. Oh, at the end of the Clinton years, we were doing very well. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. 20 years ago, government still had some teeth in. It was still a regulatory engine. It's just when George Bush came and totally dismantled government down to its bare bones. And put a bunch of inept people within this short period of time, people realized maybe perhaps we do need some government.
I'll tell you this, Kevin, after the break, I'm going to play some of Governor Bobby Jindal's response. And to me, the part that I laughed the hardest, the part that was most tone deaf of all, was when Governor Jindal cited Katrina as an example of why we can't trust government.
God, that was sad.
It was so sad. It was beautiful. It was sublime. Here's Governor Jindal saying, because Republicans don't know how to run government, you should never trust government. Here, we are the people that hate government. You put us in charge, we destroy government. Therefore, government can never work.
Yeah.
It's almost like saying, the Soviet Union, that communist government destroyed the Soviet Union, so obviously government never works. Rather than communism not working. It's an amazing thing. He's saying we can never help people. And yet, there were hurricanes in the Clinton era. There was Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Hugo, and they did none of the damage that Katrina did. There were warnings to fix the levees. I mean, it's shocking what he says. Because we were so incompetent, therefore government is always incompetent. Therefore, vote us in because we hate government. It's like a great little circle here. Vote Republicans in. They destroy the country. Then they say, see, don't vote for Democrats because government destroys the country. Then people vote for more Republicans and there's more government destruction. It's a wonderful little circle there.
Well, you know what the conservatives' agenda is?
Well, I know what Governor Norquist's agenda is. He said to make the government so small that we can drown it in a bathtub.
If you ever want to see the conservative agenda, as we know, the Republican Party's agenda, rent that Will Smith movie, Wild West. I know it's not the best of Will Smith's outing, but that movie, Wild Wild West, if you ever
Fair
remember
enough.
It, see. Okay.
Fair enough. Well, I'll check rent it out. I need to take a break.
Okay, then.
I need to take a break, but thanks for your call, Kevin. I want to invite others to call in as well. It's 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. When we come back, I'm going to play some of the Republican response, just because we all need a giggle every now and then. 877-4HEAD-ON, be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I watched Obama's speech, and I was impressed with his performance and his command, and with some, but only some, of what he had to say. I liked his call to bold action, but his defense of government intervention in the economy was neither as fulsome nor as persuasive as the one he offered at his first press conference. In his speech, he gave a quick tour of previous positive public interventions and said, government didn't supplant private enterprise, it catalyzed private enterprise. Well, that's not exactly true. During World War II, government basically ran the economy. And should government's only role be to catalyze capitalism? Plus, did Obama really have to say that he didn't believe in bigger government? He's now in the midst of a tough ideological battle with the Republicans, and he just surrendered an enormous amount of territory. Likewise, he didn't need to propose and then stress that 90% of the jobs in his recovery plan will be in the private sector. Those will be largely non-union jobs and less secure ones at that. Nor did he have to reiterate his pledge to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. That's precisely the wrong thing to do in the Great Recession, and he'll either accomplish this goal and kill off the recovery or fail to meet the goal he foolishly set for himself. And while he had the cutting knife in his hand, he also menaced Social Security with it. Now, he did hit some populist notes, like talking tough with the bankers, but too often his coda was oddly conservative. I'm Matt Rothschild. And that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I was listening during the break to Matt Rothschild's commentary, and I disagree with him. I actually disagree with him a lot. I think that President Obama did hit the right notes in that speech, and I think it's perfectly fine. In fact, one of my favorite lines was the line that he criticized, the one where he said government catalyzes private industry. What a wonderful word. A catalyst, of course, is a small thing that goes in and makes a large reaction, right? You put a small catalyst in a solution, and eventually the solution starts in and of itself. A catalyst is teaching a man to fish so that he can make fish all the rest of his days without needing you to keep teaching him. There's nothing wrong with government being a catalyst for private industry. I don't want an economy run by the government. I agree with President Obama there. I am not a socialist, nor am I a capitalist. I believe in a mixture of socialism and capitalism. I always have. And I don't think pure socialism works, just like I don't think pure capitalism works. Pure capitalism leads to a small group of very rich people and a huge amount of poor people, much like America was at the end of the 19th century. But pure socialism doesn't work either because people don't have any incentives to work hard. No, I believe we need a combination, and there's nothing wrong with President Obama saying that 90% of the jobs will be in the private sector. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. I'm not knocking government jobs, but I'm not knocking private sector jobs either. Yes, they should be union jobs, of course. But let's not knock the private sector. The point is that a well-regulated private sector can do a lot of good. can do a lot of good for the economy. There were good times in Bill Clinton's years, and most of it wasn't through government programs, but through government making it easier for businesses to do the right thing. How do you do that? Well, you regulate them. You make sure they're not defrauding people. You make CEOs accountable to their shareholders. You do things like President Obama's cap and trade system so that the government, so that polluters can pollute, but the pollution is limited and only limited to those that give the most bang for the buck, right? They cap and trade it. They sell it. If somebody can make millions and millions of dollars from a small amount of pollution, then it's worth it to them. But you cap the total amount of pollution. These are mixed government-private solutions, and they're the kind that work. Now, obviously, I don't think the private enterprise can do it all. You look at something like healthcare, and the private enterprise has made a huge mess of it. Look at Social Security, and it's absolutely necessary the government provide for retirement. Businesses aren't providing pensions, and God help anyone who had all their money in the stock market rather than relying on Social Security. There are things government does better than private enterprise. There are things private enterprise does better than government, and there are times they work well together. I liked that word, catalyst. To me, that's the heart of what President Obama is doing and what he should be doing, not government taking over the economy, but catalyzing private industry. And if necessary, and only if necessary, taking over the economy. Perhaps the best example is the banks. Now, would I support temporary nationalization of some of the worst banks? Yeah, I probably would. There are times when private industry becomes such a mess the government has to step in and take over. Would I support permanent nationalization of all the banks? No. No, I wouldn't. I don't think that would be a good idea. I think sometimes you need people trying different things. So we have a Federal Reserve that's national, that's controlled by the government, but we also have private banks. To me, private-public partnerships are exactly the right way to go. And I think President Obama is doing a good job. One of the things that he did say, by the way, one last quote from President Obama on the banks, is he said that we will act with the full force of the federal government to ensure the major banks that Americans depend on have enough confidence and enough money to lend even in more difficult times. And when we learn that a major bank has serious problems, he said, we will hold accountable those responsible, that's very important, force the necessary adjustments, provide the support to clean up their balance sheets, and assure the continuity of a strong, viable institution that can serve our people and our economy. He goes on to say that he understands that Wall Street may be more comforted by an approach that gives banks bailouts with no strings attached and holds nobody accountable, but such an approach won't solve the problem. He said, I intend to hold those banks fully accountable for the assistance they receive, and this time they will have to clearly demonstrate how taxpayer dollars result in more lending for the American taxpayer, at which point even the Republicans stood up. The same Republicans that supported giving Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson under George Bush the power to really do whatever he wanted. The reason why there was no accountability is because the Republican administration don't have accountability. And if President Obama does not insist on the accountability, if these are mere words, if the banks are not required to show where every penny is going, if the CEOs are still rewarded with fancy jets and bailout packages, well, I'll be the first to criticize them. I want to move on to, the humor of the evening. To Governor Bobby Jindal, who I thought was hilarious. Probably, no, almost certainly, unintentionally so. And maybe no more so than when he used the example of Hurricane Katrina to argue that government can never succeed. Would you want to have a governor who doesn't believe that government can ever succeed? Listen to what Bobby Jindal said about Hurricane Katrina.
Today in Washington, some are promising that government will rescue us from the economic storms raging all around us. Those of us who lived through Hurricane Katrina, we have our doubts. Let me tell you a story. During Katrina, I visited Sheriff Harry Lee, a Democrat and a good friend of mine. When I walked into his makeshift office, I had never seen him so angry. He was literally yelling into the phone, "Well, I'm the sheriff. And if you don't like it, You can come and arrest me. Haskin, Sheriff, what's got you so mad? They told me they'd put out a call for volunteers to come with their boats to rescue people who were trapped on their rooftops by the floodwaters. The boats were all lined up and ready to go. And then some bureaucrat showed up and told them they couldn't go out in the water unless they had proof of insurance and registration.
So what's the conclusion that Bobby Jindal draws from that? That the bureaucrat was wrong? That perhaps the government, the George Bush presidency, should overrule that bureaucrat? That perhaps government could be run better? No, his conclusion is, we don't need government. We don't need government. Hurricane Katrina, the people will just have to find a way out of the floodwaters through private means. You know, as they're on the top of the roofs, as the rivers are rising, let's hope people come and save them. Let's hope so. We don't need government to do evacuation or to let people know the hurricane's coming. No. We'll have private people shot with megaphones. We don't even need government to build levees. Right? If private people want to build a wall around the floodwaters of the Mississippi River, which happened to be higher than the land around New Orleans, well, private industry will do it. They'll just do it. If there's a hole in the levee, well, everyone needs to just stand there with their finger in the hole. He really made that argument. Because Republicans failed, because they were incompetent, because Brownie, the Arabian horse trader, did a heck of a job, we can never trust government to do the right thing. And he said it with a straight face. And have you noticed the way he tells stories? Is there anyone else that thinks that maybe Republicans are like little children? Oh, let me tell you, girls and boys, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you about Hurricane Katrina. So the sheriff said, ooh, you should just arrest me too. This sing-song voice, this is the rising star of the Republican Party? This is the guy who's their main nominee for president? He can't even talk to the American people like adults. Listen to how he begins his speech. Listen to how jarring it is, at least in my ears, to hear him praise, you know, the first African-American president, when we have a president who's beyond that already. He's our president. And President Obama is worried about saving the economy. And he didn't mention the historic nature of him being the first African-American president. That's done. It's happened. We're glad about it. Let's move on and roll up our sleeves and get something done. And yet, Bobby Jindal goes on and on about, it's so nice we have a black president. Did anyone else think that sounded condescending? Does it sound to you like he's talking to little children? That he's in the first grade classroom? Let me tell you, girls and boys, this is Bobby Jindal. And this is the way it's supposed to be. Maybe, you know, the 70% of Americans that support Democrats these days. Maybe the infantile speech doesn't work for them, but still does for the 30% that remain Republicans. Listen to how Governor Jindal begins his speech.
Good evening and happy Mardi Gras. I'm Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana. Tonight, we witnessed a great moment in the history of our republic. In the very chamber where Congress once voted to abolish slavery.
Hi, I'm Bobby Jindal. Tonight, we had a great moment in the history of the republic, boys and girls. And it was just really, really wonderful, he goes on to say.
Our first African-American president stepped forward to address the state of our union. With his speech tonight, the president completed a redemptive journey that took our nation from Independence Hall to Gettysburg to the lunch counter, and now finally the Oval Office. Regardless of party, all Americans are moved by the president's personal story. The son of an American mother and a Kenyan father who grew up to become leader of the free world.
Regardless of party, boys and girls, we can be happy that this man became leader of the free world. You see, we're not racist in the Republican Party. We like black people, too. Some of our best friends are black. And it's okay. It's really okay. Some blacks are even articulate. Some of them even become president of this United States, boys and girls. But sometimes we disagree. You know, I don't know. Did anyone else think that President Obama talked to us like adults, and Bobby Jindal talked to us like children? I mean, one of my favorite moments in Bobby Jindal's speech was when he talked about Barack Obama raising taxes. Raising taxes? Oh, you mean the taxes that are going to be raised on those that make more than $250,000 a year? That's what you're so upset about? Even though President Obama made clear and repeated himself and even said, some are going to tell you otherwise. I love the way he sort of predicted exactly. Well, it's almost like he'd read Bobby Jindal's speech. President Obama said, look, that's only for those that make over $250,000 a year. Bobby Jindal, you're not fooling anyone. He talked about $8 billion in mass transit for high-speed trains, like those going from Las Vegas to Disneyland. Well, first of all, Mr. Jindal, there is no plan on the books that I know of, that you know of, for a train that goes from Las Vegas to Disneyland. But you know what? A high-speed train from Las Vegas to Los Angeles with maybe a stop in Anaheim, would that be a bad idea? Do you know how many Americans go to Las Vegas every year? Do you know how many Americans go to Disneyland every year? Do you know how much that helps our economy? Do you know how many people work at Disneyland and in Southern California? That's one of the main routes. In fact, the whole purpose of a high-speed train is to go where large groups of people travel relatively short distances. That's why a high-speed train makes sense on the Washington-New York-Boston corridor. A high-speed train would make sense in the 4 hours it takes to drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Better a high-speed train than all those cars using all that gasoline. Now, it would not make sense, I'll be the first to tell you, to have a high-speed train from Los Angeles to New York. That doesn't make sense. But Los Angeles to Las Vegas? I don't know. Sounds like a good idea to me. In Japan, they have trains that go more than 200 miles an hour. In France, they have trains that go more than 200 miles an hour. I thought we started the train. Didn't we? I don't know. I don't know who invented the train, the locomotive. But I know this, that America in the late 19th century was the leading train country on Earth. Why do we fall so far behind? Well, because governments like France and governments like Japan were pressing the latest technology, which includes, and I know it sounds fancy to you, Governor Bobby Jindal, but levitation sounds like a magic trick. But you know what? It actually works. The fastest trains, believe it or not, run on a current of air. And if that sounds too fancy and too technologically sophisticated for you, Governor Bobby Jindal, I invite you to join the 21st century. Oh, it's such a waste of money. What else did he say was a waste of money? Not the rainforest in Iowa that Republicans approved under Charles Grassley, or even the statues to Robert Byrd approved by the Democratic senator. No, volcano monitoring. That's what he had. That was the worst thing he could complain about. Trains, high-speed trains like they have in France and in Japan between L.A. and Las Vegas, and volcano monitoring. Well, you know what? If you live near Mount St. Helens, you probably want them to monitor the volcano. You know what, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana? You probably would be against levee monitoring, too, wouldn't you? Oh, no, that one's okay. Well, it's okay to monitor the levees that if they break, cause a deluge that causes a whole city to flood in New Orleans, but it's not okay to monitor a volcano that if erupts could put a city in the Northwest under lava? What's the difference, Governor Jindal? You want to monitor the levees and not the volcanoes? No, you know what? I take you at your word. You don't want to do any monitoring. After all, government failed in Katrina. Let the people drown. Let them drown. Let them hope that some private industry will get them out. Great. He said so many things. It was amazing. Jindal said that he actually supports health care for everyone. He supports universal health care. You ever heard a Republican support universal health care? Bobby Jindal said it. He just wants it to be provided by private interests. And what incentive, Governor Jindal, will these private interests have to give health care to the poor? The goodness of their hearts, perhaps? Is that what it is? Jindal also talked about the corruption in Congress. Yet I seem to recall the great majority of corrupt members of Congress being Republicans. Yeah, there was the one guy, maybe in your home state, Louisiana, but the rest of them, from Jack Abramoff to Bob Ney to Duke Cunningham, Doolittle, I mean, they were all Republican, weren't they? And even transparency I found fascinating. Here we have come from the most secret government in American history to the most open government in American history, and Jindal says it's not transparent enough. What other president has put an 1,100-page bill on the Internet at recovery.gov explaining what each and every provision does? Not just the full 1,100-page bill, but an exact numbering of how much money goes to which program and laying it out for every American to see. That's pretty transparent as far as I'm concerned. But perhaps the highlight of Governor Jindal's speech was near the end. And I'm going to try to find this in the last minute or two, where he says that that Republicans lost the people's trust. I couldn't agree with him more.
Distinctions in philosophy became less clear. Our party got away from its principles. You elected Republicans to champion limited government, fiscal discipline, and personal responsibility. Instead, Republicans went along with earmarks and big government spending in Washington. Republicans lost your trust, and rightly so. Tonight, on behalf of our leaders in Congress and my fellow Republican governors, I say this. Our party is determined to regain your trust.
Huh? Republicans lost your trust, and rightly so. You were wrong to trust us. You put us in power, and we ran off and spent like drunken sailors, mostly on, you know, things that would help our friends in the oil companies and, our friends at Halliburton, and to have a few wars, and, well, we lost several billion. But you put your trust in us, and that trust was misplaced. But don't trust the Democrats. Don't trust the Democrats because we were bad rulers. They must be bad rulers. Because we failed in government, government must of necessity fail. This is the best Republicans have? This is the highlight of the Republican Party? This is the future? Governor Bobby Jindal talks to us as if we were in first grade and tells us that Republicans failed. Well, I agree with him on that one. Therefore, never trust government again. That's their best? Sadly, I think it is their best. You compare Bobby Jindal to Sarah Palin, and he's a regular college professor. They have a bankrupt philosophy. And it's impossible to defend even an intelligent guy like Bobby Jindal, a bankrupt philosophy. And so you had last night the difference between a proud, confident, bold President of the United States and a timid opposition whose only response is, no, 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 we failed before, but, well, we won't do it again. And, by the way, don't trust government, because they always fail, just because we did. President Obama's agenda is far more bold, far more uplifting, far more optimistic. And I, for one, kind of want to watch that State of the Union one more time. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Next up, your hillbilly elitist, Bob Kincaid. This is Mark Levine, signing off.
go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard. I'm still kind of reeling. I don't know about you, but that was some Jim Dandy good music we had here live in the studio last night. Doesn't happen a whole lot, so when it does, it's really quite exciting, and I want to extend my thanks both to our musician, artist, buddy, T. Page Del Porto at tpage.com, T-P-A-I-G-E.com, as well as master photographer, human rights activist, environmental activist, Paul Corbett Brown, paulcorbettbrown.com, paulcorbettbrown.com. It was really quite an exciting evening, and frankly, I don't think this studio has ever quite rocked the way that Paige had it rocking a couple of times. And I also want to send out a special shout out and thank you to everybody who has done such a magnificent job of getting the horn almost level West Virginia video out there. I had a look back before, a couple of hours back, and at that time, we were up around on the order of 2,500 views since, Friday? And that is pretty astonishing. And I want to thank everybody who's been part of that process. Quite amazing, really. And the amazing on a number of levels, one of which was the simple creation of the video. Tanya Adkins has a beautiful singing voice, and she assembled some magnificent musicians to bring that song to life. And then horn videographer Sue Amsbaugh put it together with a vision that is simply visually stunning. And I just took a peek in to see where we're at, and yeah, 2,615 views. In other words, we've added about 100 views just in a couple of hours, which is really pretty neat for what this is. So thanks for getting it out there. And it's being dug, and it's being stumbled upon. So help that get viral. Help people see what's going on here. Because, you know, we're very good at getting information out amongst ourselves. It is where we need to get better is in our effort to reach people that we would not ordinarily reach, or who might not necessarily be thinking about the issue. So that's just by way of a little bit of housekeeping this evening. And by way of a thank you. Thank you to folks who have chimed in on the contributions in the last few days to try to get us up at least past the halfway mark of our February goal, and you have indeed done that, and I am ever so grateful for you having done so, because it really does make things a little more doable around here. Because, among other things, when we don't make our monthly goals, that means that we continue to pour what we have of our own resources into this process. And when you make that, make it possible for us not to have to do that, that's kind of like not having to eat your own seed corn, if you know what I mean. So thank you. Thank you very much. I just rolled in the door, had to make a little road trip to go and get a couple of errands taken care of. I was in Beckley on a couple of things, one of which didn't pan out and another one which did, so we batted 500 on the run. Trying to pull things together here, my lovely wife Agnes is trying to get laundry done and stuff washed and folded and tucked away and packed and so forth because, the whole tribe is going to power shift in D.C. at the end of the week. That's Agnes, me, Margie, Ferg, and Doodle. And from time immemorial, moving all of us together, it used to include, of course, Lorelei. She'll be staying here, though, looking after the next generation of little members of the tribe. It used to be that I said that getting us all out the door and moving, going anywhere, across the yard, across town, across country, to the grocery store, gas station, what have you, that any of that was like unto moving the children of Israel across Sinai. You know, one step forward and two steps back, a real struggle. And none of that has changed, frankly. So Agnes is in field marshal mode. And she's trying to pull things together to make this trip a success so that we don't wind up 253 miles down the road when I suddenly look up and say, "Oh, I forgot!" Fill in the blank. So that's what's going on around here. Some rather busy days. Rather busy indeed. But that doesn't mean that we're not plugged in and paying attention to what's happening in the world at large. A couple of things that I want to catch up with from last night that caught my attention. Something I mentioned briefly, and that is this article that appeared on MSN yesterday. I think I even mentioned the title of it. The title was, "Hey GM, Can I Retire at 48 too?" Which is a kind of a snide and a snarky approach to the issue of the retirement program that the United Auto Workers had with General Motors. 30 years and you get to retire. You know, 30 years of one's life is enough for any American corporation, isn't it? I'm just asking. How much before retirement? These are good blue collar jobs, or were good blue collar jobs. You get out of high school, you got your high school sheepskin in hand, and the local culture says that that's when you go into the assembly plant. You go onto the assembly line, or you do something in the plant there. And there were hundreds of communities like that where that was the culture. And as was reminded of us, I believe it was our buddy David in Tennessee who did this, there was a deal cut once upon a time where back-end retirement money was swapped for front-end pay raises, and management laughed all the way to the bank. I think if I recall David's story, that was that happened right around the late 60s. And, yeah, management laughed all the way to the bank. Except now that they have to honor the obligations which they incurred, they don't like it so much. So consequently, we get articles like, "Hey GM, can I retire at 48 too?" I don't know if Paul Ingracia of the Wall Street Journal wrote that headline, or if there's some other little right-wing hack who wrote it for him. But I'd like to have a little sit-down conversation with the both of them, frankly. Because, maybe we ought to be having a discussion in this country
about what it means to be a working American. I mean, I know there's that line in 16 Tons where whoever it was sang, "Oh, my soul to the company store." But is that really what we want? Because underlying that smarmy, divisive query,
"Hey, GM, can I retire at 48, too?"
is this argument that corporate America has that our job as working class people is to labor under the damn lash until we drop the hell dead and then be grateful for the rest. And frankly, that irks me no end. Retirement should mean something. 30 years should mean something more than a stupid watch. Start in at 18, finish at 30, finish 30 years later at 48 years old. Yeah, what the hell's wrong with retiring there? Maybe at 48, after years of back-breaking labor on the assembly line, maybe then you think, maybe that's when you go and take those violin lessons. Or maybe you just go fishing. But after 30 years, at the age of 48, 49, 50, whatever, if that is the age at which an American gets to first experience that true freedom, having swapped one's youth for broken health, broken bones, torn muscles, aching back, if at 48 or 49 or 50, you finally, a working person finally gets to stand up and say, "I, by God, am finally free. No one is my boss. I say yes, sir, to no one. And I do as I please." Then how dare Paul Ingracia of the Wall Street Journal begrudge that? How dare he? How dare he minimize the value of American labor? See, he doesn't care if somebody quits at 48. He just doesn't want them to have any benefits for doing it because the Wall Street Journal's a right-wing, filthy little right-wing rag anyway. Good God, what are you going to think of any publication that actually publishes op-ed pieces by the likes of the oxymoron Flush Flemball, for heaven's sakes? You know, Henry Ford II, at one point in time, was discussing trends in automobiles back when it first appeared that foreign car makers were beginning to put a dent in Detroit's bottom line. And the question at the time on the table was whether or not Detroit should wise up and start building smaller cars. You know what Henry Ford's answer was? Now, bear in mind, this isn't some guy on the assembly line. This isn't some guy who hangs passenger side doors for 30 flipping years. Actually, the workers did have some good ideas about what they should be building. They were seldom listened to by management, by the likes of Henry Ford II. Henry Ford II, however, I think it was along about 1971.